And now, let's turn to Inside the City, a weekly chat with local officials, residents, and personalities providing up-to-date and relevant information about what's happening in your city of Palmer. Moderated by Mike Malevsky.
Well, it's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio Chief of Police here in the city of Palmer, Lance Ketterling. Welcome.
Good morning, Mike.
Well, we've had a series of topics I thought of, and probably you have a few too. One of the things that I've noticed recently, the first reports have been coming in about the effectiveness of an advance in technology which allows police officers to wear cameras. And I'm thinking you have two things that you probably can share. One, observation about some of those reports that you may have seen, and observations about what's happening here in Palmer.
Sure, absolutely. There was a much more comprehensive study than has been done in the past in this country regarding body-worn cameras, and I believe it came out of Washington, D.C. Earlier studies came out of the lower 48. I believe it was out of Mesa. And it was a much smaller study, but it was with the best of intentions. I believe it was about 50 or 60 officers that had been wearing body-worn cameras. Well, this new one that came out of D.C., and it was recently released in the news a couple days ago. I believe it was 1,300 to 1,400 officers that had been wearing these cameras right. for an extended period of time over the course of about a year, year and a half. And so they have some pretty interesting observations about what these body-worn cameras do and do not do. And one of the primary focuses of that study was, does the presence of a body-worn camera, that is, of course, known to the officer and also known to the individuals they might be contacting, improve behavior for both officers and the individuals that they are video recording? Mm-hmm. And the answer in this larger study seemed to be that no, it did not do that. The smaller study out of Mesa did seem to indicate that complaints were reduced and that behavior generally improved with the presence of a body-worn camera when all involved knew that it was there. This larger study, the 1,300-1,400 officer study, seemed to indicate that no, it didn't really do that as much as they were hoping for, but nevertheless, it still was providing valuable evidence for the police department and helping in the investigation of complaints.
Okay, that's the big studies out there. What can you say about here in Palmer, Alaska?
So here in Palmer, we've been fielding body cameras since January, and what we have discovered is that as an investigative tool and an evidentiary tool, they're extremely valuable. The cameras collect great evidence, and they are very useful in court. They are very useful for the officers to document their activities and document their reports, and it makes everything fairly accurate. We have not noticed a dramatic change in behavior either from the officers, which has always been good in Palmer, or from the citizens, which is generally quite good in Palmer. And it's maybe not surprising. Most of the time, I do believe that the people we are interacting with have an idea that body cameras are present. Now, we don't necessarily tell them. We're not required to do that. But sometimes there are clear indications that people have no idea they're being recorded, or perhaps if they did know at one time, they forget when they come to talk to us later. And then we use the famous words of 60 Minutes, well, let's go to the tape. And so we get to look at the interaction again. So they have some very positive aspects. Now, the negative ones are a few. And one, it allows people like myself to view this, and this is a positive and a negative, but it allows people like me or people like the court to view the actions of the officers with something that the court generally says you don't want to view the actions of the officers with. And that's what the guidance of 20/20 hindsight. The actions of police officers when viewed through the lens of the court are generally viewed through the eyes of what a reasonable officer would perceive or what that officer perceived at the time the event was taking place. Because this is often very different than what a camera might capture. Sure. And we might be able to view, you know, 6 months later in the comfort of an office. So what the officer is actually experiencing and the totality of those circumstances has to be taken clearly into account when you're reviewing video evidence, either for criminal prosecutions or investigating a possible complaint or whatever you might be using it for.
So my sense about this is that I have the feeling that there are, in providing such a tool, there may have been some very professionally developed intentions about what to use the tool for. But when you have something that is like this, that in one sense captures information, then how that information gets to be used, where it's being used, in the court, in an evaluation of the interactions, et cetera, that's the cat's out of the box. You can't control the way in which it is going to be used in the future. So,
yes, and that is yes and no. And that's something that we definitely take into consideration when we were drafting policy and procedure for how to use these cameras. While on patrol, the officers wear their body cams and they activate them under the circumstances dictated in our policy and our SOP. But some of the things that our concerns were is there a potential for a violation of privacy? For example, the department with regularity goes to disturbances in private homes, which wind up being nothing more than a shouting match between two spouses, as is typical to happen. Okay. It takes place. Or perhaps do we have a neighbor that heard some banging around and wanted us to go check on their neighbor next door because they know that she's on her own? Well, the entire free world probably doesn't need to have access to know what particular individuals look like in their underwear when they come to the door, because we're not catching these folks at their best most of the time.
Right.
And so, you know, what is discoverable? What is subject to a public records request? And to what degree do we release these? And it's interesting. As often as organizations, and I'll just loft out the ACLU because it's the first one that comes to mind, as often as organizations sometimes seems to be at odds with law enforcement, in this particular instance, I think they had some very sage advice, and that's body camera retention policies, while they need to comply with what their parent organization, in this case the city, has for records retention, need to be viewed in the terms of days or weeks, not months or years. In other words, how long do we keep this footage and potentially make it available for anybody that might want to discover it? Juveniles is another one. You know, what privacy rights do they have? And we also have to remember, when we're looking at this topic, that unlike many states, and unlike in the federal constitution, the U.S. Constitution, where it is implied but never expressly stated, the Alaska Constitution has a right to privacy specifically written into it. And so when you're writing policy, you have to balance that. The right to know, the right to public access, the goal of transparency balanced against the right to privacy of the individuals, not the police officers. Their right to privacy doesn't exist for all intents and purposes while they're working. People are allowed to videotape us in the course of our duties. It's just simply the way it is.
Okay.
So, and then other things, they capture everything. The camera sees a lot, often more than the officer sees. Sometimes it doesn't see what an officer does see, but some of it is footage that you just have to be extremely cautious with. It catches people in compromising moments. It catches people in, you know, engaging in behavior that they would normally never do. And so one of the keys to writing a policy for body camera video retention is that it is expressly prohibited from using this for any type of entertainment, for anything other than official police business, using it for unintended purposes is strongly prohibited in our policy.
Okay. So I'm thinking, as you were talking, as a radio station, we very often have phone interviews and the rest. But there are some very clear guidelines that require us, if we're going to record somebody, that we say, we're going to record, do you mind? We want to tell you this, so we are recording it.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of interesting when you turn to video and audio, because presumably, as I think about this, if I'm talking with somebody, I'm going to have a camera and I'm going to do the same thing. I'm recording you. I'm taking this, and I'm thinking not of the body cam so much, but just using a recording device, a video recording device.
Sure.
There's all of that that goes on to say, if if you're going to use this for some purpose, commercially, there are guidelines. But what I've noticed is with the proliferation of YouTube and the ability of Facebook to stream stuff, there doesn't seem to be much in the way of a guideline that prevents someone from taking a picture of anything and putting it up on the internet. I'm only saying this because it describes kind of a background arena within which you're placing the officer's camera video footage.
Sure. And the way that the vast majority of body camera video, not certainly all of it, but the way that the majority of it makes it onto places like the internet or YouTube is video that has been discovered either by defense or by defendants, and then our control over that video is reduced.
Okay.
And frequently the video, and we've seen this in Palmer, video that has been put onto the internet, either YouTube or otherwise, has been heavily edited to the point where, you know, the key elements that made up the initial reason for a contact or the key elements that caused an officer to respond to resistance are simply left off. And all you see is an officer using force on an individual. So, it is a manipulative, it's a media which can be manipulated. And so keeping that original copy is always something that's very key.
So you have context.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Okay. Well, thank you for those comments, both about what's happening around the country as well as here. I'm guessing body cameras are with us for a while.
They seem to be very effective. The officers actually like them a great deal.
Okay, good. Well, I'd like to shift a little bit of focus to something that's been in the news a lot, because the Alaska legislature has gathered in Juneau on a special session, and they've been focused on the topic of what to do with a law that was put on the books essentially last year with about 6 months or so experience, SB 91. And there seem to be discussions going on about, and this is the piece that fascinates me, because a number of legislators have spoken about this by saying, this is a long study, set of studies, and a lot of work that produced SB 91, a review with talking to a lot of people, and then it was produced. And now there's been a lot of what I might call pushback from many people, particularly using social media, et cetera, to contact legislators about individual and experience with what's presumed to be the situation after SB 91.
Sure.
And of course, the big question seems to be, is there enough time to judge SB 91? Where should this all go? And I have no idea what the legislature is going to do. It seems they're going to at least tweak what was put in place.
There have been a number of public meetings about this exact thing over the last several weeks. As the legislators are going to their special session, they were trying to gather information about what the public thought about SB 91. So the trick with any type of legislation and then viewing the effects afterwards is that, is this causal to the effects, or does it just happen to correlate with them?
Right.
And so 6 months ago, I don't think we could have said anything approximating cause in terms of, did Senate Bill in 91 have a causal effect on some of the negative stuff that we're seeing. I think we have a slightly better picture now in late October of this year that it might have some effect, at least in Palmer. Now, there's a lot of questions that still remain unanswered. And there are other factors at play other than just SB 91. For example, like everybody knows, we are probably in the worst heroin and opiate epidemic in the state that it may have seen ever in its entire existence. Certainly very possible. Certainly the worst one that I've seen in the last 20 years. We have a significant homeless issue across the state, especially in South Central. The economy is in something of a downturn, and all these can have effects on crime rates as well. So when we're evaluating something as dramatic as Senate Bill 91 was, and it was landscape changing, there's no two other ways to look about this. This was the most sweeping bill that has affected criminal justice in Alaska is in recent memory, certainly, and in a very, very long time. So all these things are acting on what we're seeing as the police department. However, to make a rough, not to paint the house with the whole brush or too broad a brush, but Senate Bill 91 and some of the things that have come about from its implementation have generally not had a terribly positive effect on criminal justice in the city of Palmer. And I can make that statement relatively comfortably. Now, what's the answer? I don't know exactly what the answer is to that. There are questions. Okay, would you repeal it? Would you replace it with Senate Bill 54? Would you just tweak 91? And there are a lot of factors acting on those answers. If we were to say, for example, repeal Senate Bill 91, what would the long-term effects of that be? It was a landmark, it was a groundbreaking, a sweeping bill that changed a lot. To go back and restart the clock, what would that do? How much cost would it, entail, that sort of thing? So, great questions. One of the most interesting things we're dealing with right now in Palmer is kind of a twofold effect of a statewide bail schedule, which is an own recognizance release for the vast majority of misdemeanors, and our homeless issues, because Matsu Pretrial, as most folks know, is located right in the middle of Palmer. And so when other organizations bring in an individual that they have arrested on a misdemeanor, criminal trespassing, disorderly conduct, thefts, that sort of thing, and they are booked in the Matsu Pretrial, they are released out the doors probably about an hour later into Palmer. And folks that don't have a place to live, don't have transportation, don't have any means of support, are now in our town. So I'm certainly not saying this is done intentionally, but the net effect is the same. And I think that has something to do with the increase in homeless population that so many people have commented to me about this year.
Okay. All right. Is there an organization of police, local police, statewide that has taken any position on SB 91 that you're aware of?
There probably are, but I don't follow the fraternal organizations or those organizations all that closely. I'm sure that ACOP, Alaska Association of Chiefs of Police, has one. It would not surprise me if Alaska Police Standards has a thought on this. What those official positions are for those organizations, you'd have to ask them. Okay. I would never presume to speak for other organizations in terms of what their views on 91 are.
Yeah. My sense is that a statement made by one of the legislators, Matt Klayman from Anchorage, captured for me, as reported in an Alaska Dispatch News article, that people are looking for a simple solution. He's looking for a simple solution. But in this case, this whole criminal justice system is very complicated. The simple solutions are not there.
You're absolutely right. I couldn't agree more. It seems, perhaps on the face of it, that just saying, oh, repeal Senate Bill 91 is a simple solution. And perhaps that would do some good. I'm not sure. I think in general, Senate Bill 91 is not terribly highly thought of by some in the law enforcement community. Now, the problem is criminal activity, crime in general, certainly things as complicated as social issues like homelessness or opiate abuse are not simple problems.
Right.
They were not, they have never been simple to solve. And they are certainly not solved by law enforcement, certainly not alone. We're not going to arrest our way out of these problems. It was never a possibility that we would arrest our way out of these problems. It may have some beneficial effects on public safety when we make more arrests. There is some evidence to suggest that that's the case. If for no other reason that people that are burglarizing and stealing to support an opiate habit are now no longer able to steal and burglarize in order to support their drug habit. However, police historically across the country, across the world, don't solve homelessness. They don't solve drug problems. That is done in various means through societal programs and help getting people clean, education, rehabilitation, which is, despite the increasing police mission and doing things outside of what was considered traditional law enforcement, that's still largely outside of our purview.
Okay. I'd like to switch to a third topic, which comes up because of a trip I recently made to a community which is a college town, university town, actually in northern Vermont. And I was struck when I was there with the incredible signage and striping of associated with striping of streets for crossing streets.
Okay.
So what I was aware, both walking and driving, that because there are a lot of pedestrian traffic, arguably far more than here in downtown Palmer, almost every place where there was a potential crossing that happened, there was striping, there was a pylon there, and a reminder that, in this case, state law said pedestrian has the right of way.
Right.
Okay. And I found that to be helpful to me as I was there to be aware that people were likely to be traveling that. Now, in the past, we've had discussions. I've had discussions with the city manager. I think we've even talked about it a little bit. In the city of Palmer, as I walk around, I find we have taken the minimalist approach. I mean, in the sense that when I think about crossing, Evergreen, I know I can cross here and I can go on up to the Glen Highway, but in between, there's nothing that tells me that this is a safe place to cross over. That was just one example. The purpose of my question here is, how does state law or law here affect a pedestrian? Does a pedestrian have the right of way in a crossway? Or,
well, it depends on the circumstances. Pedestrians okay. are expected, while being in the roadway, to adhere to the rules of the road, just like a vehicle would.
Okay.
So if you're crossing in a crosswalk with the lights or with the signal, then yes, you would have the right way to cross. If you are not crossing in a crosswalk and just running across, let's take a look at South Alaska Street here.
Got it.
Great street. Lovely little part of downtown Palmer. And it's frequently traveled on foot by a lot of folks that want to visit the shops. Well, what we found is that, crossing at the corners is what we would prefer, or crossing at the crosswalks sure. is what we prefer. But it seems that a high portion of the time, and I hate to say which, but probably 75% of the better, people just dart across the street and, you know, go from where they park their cars over to where the shops are, visit some of the local stores. So there are many factors at play. In the lower 48, for example, and Fort Collins is one that I'm familiar with, especially in the downtown area near the university. The culture is that pedestrians have the right of way and that cars will stop for pedestrians while they are crossing the street. Well, Alaska doesn't really have that culture yet. Uh-huh. And so most people, of course, try very, very hard not to hit a pedestrian that's crossing in front of them. Sure. Of course, they're going to do this. But they're also not expecting that pedestrian to just step out in front of them because they think that they have the right of way to cross at any moment. And in fact, according to Alaska law, they don't. So
just on that point, does it make a difference whether you're in the striped crosswalk area? We have a flashing red light that sure. doesn't say you can cross now. There's no button to push, et cetera. There's just a crosswalk there.
Crossing the street would be the same as if a vehicle were going through the intersection for okay. a pedestrian. So when it's their turn to cross at a flashing, like we do have in the center of town here, when it would be if you were in a vehicle and you were going to cross South Alaska, South Colony, say you were a pedestrian on the street, you would just wait for your turn the way anybody else
sure.
would.
Okay. All right. But if you're not there, if you're darting across in between,
then motorists will probably try to stop for you. But in the event of an accident, if you are crossing against the rules of the road,
right.
then it is entirely possible, however unpleasant, that pedestrians that are hit by a vehicle could be cited for a traffic violation or causing an accident.
Well, thank you very much. That's helpful thinking about this because as maybe the population grows or in those busy times when there's a lot of traffic, that's an important thing to remind people that even though you might have the right of way, if you're talking to a two-ton truck.
Safety first, always. Yeah. Absolutely, always. And yeah, the right-of-way is great, and you need to know when you have it and when you don't. Oh, and just as kind of aside, One thing that police officers has found is that often folks try to yield the right of way to police vehicles on a consistent basis, which is very considerate of you. And, you know, it's not that it's not appreciated, but it does slow down traffic. And just please bear in mind that if we need to get someplace, we have lights on our roof and we'll turn them on and get through intersections. So with, you know, out of the kindness of your hearts, there's no need to yield the right of way to police vehicles unless we're asking for it.
And in a related moment, I came across a piece describing a new law in a nice place, Honolulu, which provides a fine of $35 if someone is using their smartphone while crossing the street.
A pedestrian?
Yes.
Interesting. Yeah, very interesting.
So, and the article was kind of interesting, pointing out that we've talked about here in the state of Alaska, texting while driving is a no-no.
Mm-hmm.
But texting while walking across the street in Honolulu will get you a $35 fine.
Yeah. How do you legislate situational awareness? That's an interesting concept. Yeah, be aware of your surroundings so you don't walk into the fountain in the mall while you're texting. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so all that. Well, we've come nearly to the end. Mike Malevsky here. I've been talking with Palmer's Police Chief, Lance Kettling. Do you have any last comments before we finish up?
No, just everybody stay safe on the roads and have a safe and happy Halloween.
Oh, that's right. That's coming up here.
It is indeed.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I double that. Yes.
You've been listening to Inside the City, a weekly chat with local folks providing up-to-date and relevant information about what's happening in your city of Palmer. Moderated by Mike Malevsky. This program is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, the station, or its underwriters. If you have any comments or questions, please email manager@radiofreepalmer.org.